conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest is Mary Robinette Cole. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, featuring conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about their creative process. I am myself a science fiction and fantasy author. Edward Willett is my name. My main publisher is Daw Books. I'm up to my 10th novel with them, Master of the World, which is book two in The World Shapers series, which if you would go to my website at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett, you can read all about. This podcast, The World Shapers, I'm honored to say, won the Aurora Award for Best Fan-Related Work in 2019. The Aurora Awards are fan-nominated and voted on awards here in Canada, sort of the equivalent to the Hugos in the United States. So I was very honored to win that award. And I'd like to tell you about something that's coming up with The World Shapers. Now, this is the final podcast of 2019. So my next one, which will feature Candace Jane Dorsey, will be the first one of 2020. And something else I want to see happen in 2020 are a couple of books related to the podcast. I have my own little publishing company, Shadow Paw Press, which you can check out at shadowpawpress.com. And yes, it is named after our cat, and that's his picture, is our logo. I am hoping to put out an anthology of original fiction and some reprints from guests of the first year of the podcast, which was from August 2018 to August 2019. So, that's people like Shauna McGuire, Tanya Huff, and a number of others of that ilk and level who have said that they will take part in that. I will most likely be doing a Kickstarter for that sometime in the new year, so keep your ears and eyes open for that. And I will certainly, of course, talk it up on the podcast as I get more details. And also in the new year, I'd like to bring out a collection of nonfiction based on the interviews on this podcast of writing advice and writing-related topics. So I hope to find time to work on that during the new year and bring that out. And that, again, would focus on the first year of the podcast. And as the podcast reaches its second year, which will be in August 2020, then I'll look, hopefully, at doing an anthology and also nonfiction book based on the second year. That's my plan anyway. I am, of course, a one-man operation, and I have my own books to write. The aforementioned World Shaper series is up to book three. I'm writing, well, editing it right now, revising it for submission. It will go to my editor in January, so that's taking up a bit of time right now. It's called The Moonlit World, and if you go to my website that I mentioned previously, you can see the cover art for that and read a bit of a description. The working title for a long time was Werewolves and Vampires and Peasants, Oh My! So that's the kind of world that my character, Shauna Keys, who's traveling from world to world and trying to gather the knowledge of these shaped worlds within this vast labyrinth and take them to Ygrere, who's the mysterious figure at the center of it. She's going to be in a lot of different worlds, and this time around it's a vampire and werewolf sort of world. So that's kind of fun. I should also mention, before we get on to the meat of this podcast, that this podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. We are supported by Kinexus Credit Union. All right, let's move on to this episode's interview, Mary Robinette Cole. Mary Robinette Cole is the author of the Lady Astronaut duology and historical fantasy novels, the Glamorist History series, and Ghost Talkers. She's a member of the award-winning podcast Writing Excuses and has received the Astounding Award for Best New Writer, 4 Hugo Awards, the RT Reviews Award for Best Fantasy Novel, the Nebula, and Locus Awards. Stories have appeared in Strange Horizons, Asimov's Several Years Best Anthologies, and her collections Word Puppets and Scenting the Dark and other stories. Her novel, Calculating Stars, which we will be focused on in this podcast, is one of only 18 novels to win the Hugo, Nebula, and Locus Awards in a single year. As a professional puppeteer and voice actor, Mary Robinette has performed for Lazy Town, the Center for Puppetry Arts, Jim Henson Pictures, and founded Other Hand Productions. Her designs have garnered to UNAMA USA Citations of Excellence, the highest award an American puppeteer can achieve. And she records fiction for authors such as Shauna McGuire, who's been a guest on this program, John Scalzi, who's been a guest on this program, Cory Doctorow, who hasn't yet been a guest on this program, but maybe someday. Mary Robinette lives in Nashville with her husband, Rob, and over a dozen manual typewriters. Welcome to The World Shapers, Mary Robinette.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm glad to have you. And I have to confess, I haven't quite finished Calculating Stars. I was working on it, so I'm about, I don't know, 3/4 of the way through. But you won't give any spoilers anyway, because I'm going to get you to synopsize it here in a little bit, so that, for people who haven't read it. So
okay.
But I'm enjoying it very much, and not least because I'm married to an engineer. So
ah, yes.
Who identifies with some of the situations in the story.
Yes. I found that people in STEM have a strong connection to certain aspects, especially women in STEM.
Well, before we get to that, I'll take you back into, as I always say this, it's becoming a cliche on the podcast, I will take you back into the mists of time to find out how you, first of all, became interested in writing, and specifically writing science fiction, and, you know, how you got started, in other words, and maybe a little bit about, you know, where you grew up and all that kind of stuff.
So I grew up in North Carolina. My dad worked for IBM, and he used to take me to visit him at work sometimes. They had it was in the days when the computers were still ginormous rooms, and we didn't yet have personal computers. There were gerbil tubes connecting the building. The first programming that I did was my name with punch cards. And so that was, it felt very science fictional. It felt very much like what you'd see on the Jetsons and things like that. And then we also would watch, I got connected to Doctor Who, you know, Tom Baker was my doctor, and we listened to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy on the radio. So there is not a point in my life where I remember discovering science fiction. It was something that was just always present. The earliest books that I read that I have concrete memories of are things like Enchantress from the Stars.
I remember that one.
And yeah, so good. And, you know, of course, other things like Wrinkle in Time and all of these books that were just shelved as books, but I gravitated to the ones that had a fantastic element. When I started writing, which I did pretty young, my mom sent me to a writing workshop, camp. And I was basically writing the things that I was reading. And since I was reading science fiction and fantasy, it seemed only natural that's what I was also writing. My friends also were into that. So some of the earliest stuff that I was writing was actually, we had this, we called it the note. It was a notebook, and we would pass it to each other between classes and write a cooperative story and then pass it to the next person who would pick it up and continue on. Mm-hmm. So it was... It was very much a part of my life, but I was also one of those kids who wanted to do everything. So I was an art major. I went to school to be an art major. I performed with a puppet company, a puppet troupe in high school, and then my junior year of college left to do an internship at the Center for Puppetry Arts in Atlanta, Georgia, intending to go back. And never did, and then had a 25-year career in puppetry. But the first 10 of that, I more or less, somewhere in there, I stopped writing because I was getting my creative jollies from puppetry. So for me, it's all varying forms of storytelling.
I mean, you're the first one I've talked to who's done puppetry. I have talked to several authors, myself included, who have a theatrical background. And I always like to ask if that theatrical side, and I mean, puppetry is a form of theater. It's a little different than moving actors around on age, but you're on stage, but you're still moving, you know, things in relationship to each other and characters interacting with each other. Have you found that your puppetry has helped you
yes.
with your writing or influenced
yes, absolutely. It absolutely has. First of all, because puppeteers are actors, and we are doing theater. It's just that the rather than putting on a costume, we have an external manifestation, but we are still acting. The derogatory term that we have for people who do not do puppetry are meat puppets, meat actors. So meat actor is what we usually go with, or a fleshy as opposed to a plushy. So
I'm gonna remember that.
Yeah. But it is very much acting. I think of it as the Ginger Rogers of theater. I have to do everything that you'd have to do backwards and on high heels. There's multiple advantages to it. One of which is because I am working an inanimate object, my job as a puppeteer requires me to take the body language that we do naturally, that we often don't even think about, we just do it, break it apart into its semantic components, and then reconstruct it in an inanimate object in a form that is human readable. That is essentially what I am doing as a writer as well. I have to understand the basic components, semantic pieces of body language. And here I am the tool that I'm using to reconstruct them are words on a page. But the basic building blocks, the components are the same. For instance, if someone is curious about something, they'll do what we call an aggressive motion, which is a movement towards. If there's something they don't want to engage with, they'll do a regressive motion. And while it's very easy to do that with a puppet, and as an actor, you'll do it without even thinking about it very naturally. On the page, it also plays out the same way. There's a very big difference between what did you say? She leaned across the table. And what did you say? She pushed back from the table. And one of those is the aggressive motion, and one is the regressive. But it tells you a great deal about the character's reaction without having to use like a Tom Swifty dialogue tag to denote tone.
That's very interesting. I hadn't thought of it in that way, but yeah, I can, in a way, our characters are puppets and that we are making them come alive. Something that is actually not alive. We are trying to communicate that to the reader.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's with theater, with writing, regardless of which form you're using, I think that a lot of what we're trying to do is to create an emotional response in our audience's brain, whether they are reading or viewing. But the things that we have emotional responses to, those actually remain fairly consistent from medium to medium. It's just the mechanical technique that you use to convey it. And that's one of the things that I'm trained as a puppeteer, is that there are principles that make a puppet look alive, but the mechanics differ when you move from one style to another. Like the mechanical movement that I will do with my arm for a regressive motion, if I'm doing something that's very much like a Muppet, is completely different than the mechanical motion that I'm doing also with my arms, but holding a marionette control. It's mechanically very different, but the thing that I'm trying to create for the audience, that illusion, is still the same illusion. It's still that regressive motion, or it's still the sense of muscle where I'm using a compress expand to mimic the moment when you bend your knees to jump. All of those things are still there. It's still trying to create that same effect for the audience. And I feel that way when I move to writing. It's like I'm still trying to create that effect. It's just I have a different mechanical tool now.
And when did you then move back into writing after your 25 years of puppetry? What brought that about?
Well, I moved back probably about, I think it was about 15 years into the puppetry career because I had a severe puppet injury. And again, people don't think about puppetry as being particularly dangerous. But I was doing a little Shop of Horrors and working an 80-pound puppet, and we had something go tiny bit wrong on stage. We'd done it 3 months without any injuries, and just a little bit wrong. And, the puppet sheared to the side, someone hit it on stage at a time that I had it up off the ground, and no one else should have touched it. I tried to control it, and something in my wrist went, and I essentially popped a ligament. Was for various reasons. It was complicated and wound up in a cast for a year. And then did another year of physical therapy after that to regain range of motion. Mm. During that time, kind of simultaneously with that, my brother had moved to China with his kids, working for the State Department. And I wanted to, you know, stay connected to the kids, but they were not really going to... It was before Skype was really a thing. So I started writing a serial for them and remembered that I really enjoyed writing. In hindsight, I understand that what happened was the reason I had stopped for a long time was because I was getting my creative jollies from the puppetry, and that it uses puppet design and construction uses exactly the same parts of my brain as writing. It's all world building, character creation, problem solving. So when I could no longer do that, when I had to take a substantial break from it, it gave me the energy to apply that in another form, one that I hadn't visited for a while.
I often say that it's not quite the same thing, but it's similar. I was a huge Dungeons and Dragons player in university. And one reason I quit playing was because I looked at the stack of maps and, you know, characters and monsters and stuff that I had built up for my world in Dungeons and Dragons and said, you know, that's exactly the energies I should be putting into writing my fiction. And I hardly ever played again after that, but it was the same thing. You're using the same muscles, but if you use them all in one way, it's harder sometimes to use it in the other way.
Yeah, I used to play D&D with a group when I was in high school as well. You know, in high school, I would do anything to avoid doing homework, so I would just write and play D&D. But now I will only do a one-off for exactly those reasons, because the narrative is so seductive and interesting and fun, and as I get older, I have less and less energy.
And I think I'm 10 years older than you, so I definitely identify. So when did you break in and how?
So my first sale was 2005. I think that's correct. To a small press magazine called The First Line. And I love this small press. The theory is that the first line of anything is so important, but if you hand the same first line to Mark Twain, you know, if you hand him Call Me Ishmael, he will not write Moby Dick. He will write something totally different. So the first line gives you a first line, and then every story in that issue begins with the same first line. They're all wildly different. So... my first couple of sales were to them, and then I started selling to other markets as well.
And you started with short fiction, and did quite well at short fiction, looking at the awards and so forth. What did that? Were you surprised by the level of acceptance and appreciation that your fiction began to garner?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I should say that what I actually started writing were novels, but I had been told that if you wanted to break in, you needed to write short fiction, which it turns out is not true. Jim C. Hines did a survey, and it turns out that of debut authors, when you're asking them how did you break in, whether with short fiction first or just straight to novel sale, that it was actually 50-50. But I like short fiction quite a bit, and I think that it was very good for me because it allowed me to experiment with a lot of different things without having to commit so many words. So you know, it's like doing a bunch of using the D&D metaphor again. It's like doing a one-off campaign versus something that's a multi-session campaign. So doing a one-off, it was very easy to say, oh, this time I'm gonna focus on character and try to hone my character skills, or this time I'm gonna focus on description. But I was also I was surprised at how quickly I was able to start making sales. But also in hindsight, it's not surprising because by that point I had spent 15 years coming to understand narrative and audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of what I know from theater translates over. But some of it doesn't, but so much of it does. So in hindsight, I had a leg up when I came back to prose.
So did the novels start coming along then?
So I, as I said, I had started with novels. So the thing that I, the serial that I wrote for my niece and nephew was turned into a novel very quickly, which was actually the thing that made me go, huh, because I had started doing it just kind of for kicks. And then I got a little bit into it and thought, I think I have something here. How do you write a novel? And started trying to sort that out. And in the process of that, at some point, not long after I started doing this, I discovered NaNoWriMo. And decided that this was a great thing, and I was very excited about it. And I did my first one, and it was a murder mystery. And let me tell you that doing a murder mystery without outlining is questionable as a choice. And then the second one that I did was Shades of Milk and Honey, which was my first novel, first published novel. So there was another novel. It was, I call Novel Zero. That was the novel that I wrote in high school through college and finished on my second or third year on tour. But Shades of Milk and Honey was the, I guess, the third, the second novel that I completed after I got serious about it. But yeah, I did NaNoWriMo. And we, you know, I shopped that. I had shopped the thing that I wrote for my niece and nephew, but it has first novel problems that I am not invested enough in the book now to go back and fix.
Did your niece and nephew enjoy it?
They did.
Well, that's the main thing. Did.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and of course, your novel that just won the Hugo Award and the Nebula and the Locus, Calculating Stars. we'll move on to talk about that as an example of your overall creative process. And, you know, I know it's a cliche, and I know writers hate to be asked it, and the question is, where did the idea come from? But on a bigger scale, how do you generally generate ideas for stories? How does that work for you?
Sure. So the funny thing is, actually, the Calculating Stars began with a...
You know what? I skipped over one very important thing. You should give a quick description of Calculating Stars for people who haven't read it.
Oh, sure.
Before we start talking about it.
Okay. Calculating Stars is set in 1952. It's Apollo era science fiction that's women centered. I slam an asteroid into Washington, D.C. and kick off the space program fast and early and with international cooperation. My main character, Elma York, is a mathematician and a pilot, and she is working with her husband, who was the lead engineer, rocket designer for the NACA, the National, which was a real organization. It was NASA's precursor, and becomes the lead engineer for the International Aerospace Coalition. And she realizes that the asteroid has caused a runaway greenhouse effect. So we're actually looking at an extinction event, which gives impetus to get people off the planet. As a side note, I will just let people know, science, you know how you see those disaster films and there's an asteroid coming at the Earth and they divert it into the ocean? It turns out that's a really bad idea, because when you have an asteroid come through, it tears a hole in the atmosphere and then you get something called ejecta, which ejects part of the planet up into the upper atmosphere. And then it, if it's rocks, it'll fall back down. If it's water, What happens is the water vapor gets locked in the upper atmosphere. It doesn't precipitate out, and you can trigger a runaway greenhouse effect. There is some speculation that this might be what happened to Venus.
My feeling when that initially comes up and she does the math and realizes that's what's going to happen is it felt very much like Titanic, the musical, which I've been in, and Titanic, the actual thing, which is that the engineer went down, took one look at what had happened and said, this ship is going down, even though there were still, you know, 2 or 3 hours of floating around and people not believing it.
Yeah.
It was inevitable at that point. And yeah. I had that same feeling when I got to that point in the book.
Yeah, that was like when I started looking at it. And I will also say that I'm very cautious in this book to not tell you exactly how big the asteroid is, because the science on that is super complicated. And I decided that rather than being wrong about it, that I was like, well, I know that this is how it works and it is big enough to trigger these conditions, but I don't know how big that is because I don't have access to a university supercomputer modeling system to come up with something that's exactly right. And even there, it would still be, there's still opportunity for error. So anyway, so that's what the book is about. It's basically getting into space in the 1950s. And it's the push towards the moon. The idea came because I had written a novelette called The Lady Astronaut of Mars, which I wrote for an anthology called Ripoff. It was an audio anthology. And the premise of Ripoff was actually very much like the First Line magazine, which was that the first line is so important. But instead of us all having the same first line, we each got to pick a first line, a famous classic first line, and then write a different story. And I picked the opening line of Wizard of Oz and wrote something that was, I wanted a Bradbury homage, something that reminded me of the Martian Chronicles. And that created the story of Elma York and her husband Nathaniel, who were both in Lady Astronaut of Mars, older. Elma is in her 60s. Nathaniel is older than she is. He's in his 70s. And the decisions that they have to make. And the backstory for this piece of fiction was this asteroid strike. And the more I started thinking about it, the more I was like, you know, it would be really interesting to know what she was doing when that happened. And I had written a couple of other short pieces in this universe before I really decided to unpack it into a novel. I jokingly call it my punch card punk universe because they are much, the computing is a little bit behind where the real timeline went.
Yes, I love the fact that the computers are having to check the work of the IBM machine.
Oh yeah, well, I mean that was true.
I've read that. Yeah.
Yeah. They were not completely reliable, and we lost. Is it one of the Voyagers? The name's just gone out of my head. But we lost an early rocket because they had the computers, who were women, had written the code, had written, you know, this is the plan, and then they had given it to the Air Force and they had keyed it in to the punch cards to load it onto the rocket, and had transposed something. And so the rocket wound up crashing. So it's a really interesting era in computing and rocketry. And I just got more and more, like, I've always been interested in space, but the longer I work in this universe and become versed in the early space program and the contemporary space program, the more interested I am in what we're doing and how it affects people.
It's I find it very interesting because, of course, they're doing all this. They're heading to the moon and everything, but it's 10 years earlier than it actually happened, and the technology is that much more primitive, and yet it could have been done then. And it's very much in that golden age of science fiction era, you know, with Heinlein and rockets being built and by teenagers in the backyard, practically.
Well, and when you start, like, when you really start looking at the early history of spacecraft, spaceflight, I recommend Breaking the Chains of Gravity by Amy Shira Tittell, which is a history of pre-NASA spaceflight, the history of spaceflight up until NASA exists, basically. And the early days were actually teenagers in rockets in Germany. There was this whole rocketry club. That's where Wernher von Braun came from. That's the V2 is a descendant of that. And it was, you know, it was kids who were like, I'd love to go to the moon. Can I build this thing?
Now, you've talked about a couple of stories which started with first lines that came from elsewhere. When you're not starting with the first line,
yeah,
where do story ideas tend to come to you from?
It's random. you know, the thing people always say is the idea is not the hard part. It's the challenge is turning it into a story. So I will approach it in a couple of different ways, depending on the situation. Sometimes I will sit down and I'll just free write something, and then I will sort of do a diagnostic look at it to see where I'm going and what I need to do to continue this in a satisfying way. Other times, you know, if I'm writing for an anthology or I have an idea that I'm having trouble getting traction on, then I will do something that's much more mechanical, where I will start breaking the story apart in different permutations to see where the idea could come from. There's an organizational theory called the mice quotient, which holds that every story is basically made up of four components. Milieu, which is setting, characters, inquiries, questions that you have, and events. Milieu, inquiry, character, event. And you can tell pretty much every story. You can reshape and refocus it depending on which of those you want to be the driver. Most stories have more than one element in them. And so what I will sometimes do if I'm having trouble kind of getting traction on a story is that I'll start with, you know, what I call the gee whiz idea, which is, you know, any story prompt you want to throw at me. And if I don't have an immediate hit on it, then I start interrogating it to see, you know, what are the things that could go wrong with the environment? What are the things that, you know, how could I trap someone someplace around this idea? Because a milieu story is about trying to exit a journey story. What questions might they have or not be able to answer? Is my character angsting about something? Is there something angsty that could be around this, which gives you a character story? Or is there something about this that disrupts the status quo, which is an event? And so I'll dig into those and what I'm looking for is very Marie Kondo. I'm looking for that moment where you're like, ooh, so whatever sparks joy. And then that's the thing that I'll chase.
And if nothing sparks joy, then there's not a story there.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, there is a story there, but sometimes you have to scratch at it a little bit harder. I really think you can tell a story about anything. And you can make it compelling. The first thing that I won a Hugo for is a story called For Want of a Nail. And that story, the gee whiz idea, literally, I mean, seriously, this is what's on, you know, when I came up with this, because this was one that I had to write at a workshop on a deadline-y kind of thing. So I was, I did the whole mechanical thing to jumpstart me into it. But the gee whiz idea was trouble plugging in a cable. you know, proprietary cable and trouble. You know, that was it. It was like that when you don't have the right cable.
Where we a situation we've all been in.
Yep. That was the Gee Whiz idea. And what I wound up writing, which completely is about not being able to find the right proprietary cable, is a story about a family on a generation ship and the AI, which they use to record their history and from generation to generation, gets dropped. There's a cable in a housing that's damaged. So it can no longer store to long-term memory. It can only keep things for a couple of hours, and then it's going to have to start ditching memories. And the trouble finding this cable, in the process of finding it and getting it, uncovers that the AI has been masking for a couple of different people who have Alzheimer's. And it's been covering for them because it can whisper in their ear. So it's the story unpacks into something else, but the story seed is can't find the right proprietary cable, which is not a particularly compelling story seed. That's why I'm like, ideas are everywhere. It's just, you just have to scratch at them for a little while sometimes.
It's something I say when I do school presentations about writing is, you know, if I can look around a schoolroom and have 20 different story ideas just from what they've got stuck on the walls or on their desks or whatever. So now going back to Calculating Stars, once you had your story idea, what does your planning process look like for a novel? Are you a detailed outliner, or how does that work for you? And there must have been a lot of research involved in this one too, I would think.
It varies. So this one, I had a pretty solid outline for this one. And my general approach is that I'll come up with kind of a what I call a thumbnail sketch, which is left over from my art days, which gives me sort of the basic compositional structure. And then I unpack that into a synopsis, which is like, you know, doing a rough sketch on the page. And then from there, I'll unpack the synopsis into an outline, which is kind of my armature. And each of those stages, things get adjusted and moved around as I come to understand the story a little bit more and what I want to get out of it. And I see opportunities, usually opportunities to make things worse for my characters. And then at each phase, I'm also doing research. And it gets more specific the deeper into the process I get. So with... with this one, I did fairly broad research on the early space program. I also, when I'm doing something that's historical, always assume that there were women and people of color there in real life, and that they've been written out of the narrative. So one of the things that I actively do is go looking for them. And usually those stories are significantly more interesting than the ones we've always heard, partly because we haven't heard them. They're newer stories. Like when I was working on this, I was before Hidden Figures came out. So the involvement of women of color in the space industry was something that I became aware of, and it was really cool and not something that I had heard of. And like some of the women, like, you know, Katherine Johnson, and who basically wrote, like, that is how we knew how to get to the moon, because of the programs that she wrote, the way she, that the math she did, the equations, excuse me. So I look for those, and that helps me kind of shape the story. And then I get more specific in the research. So like with these novels, my main character is a pilot. I need to know how rockets are flown, but she's not an engineer, so I don't need to know how they're built. Or rather, I need to know just enough so that when something goes wrong, I can handle it. And this is why I kind of wait until I get an outline, because what I generally find is the stuff that I need to know is related to the things that my character directly interacts with. So as I get more specific, I get a better idea about which things my character is going to need to interact with, which allows me to then hone my research. For these particular books, there is so much math and science in there that I don't have. And the level of understanding that I need to have in order to put sometimes a detail that is like three words long, but if it's the wrong three words, it's very apparent to anyone in the industry. Sometimes it's like, it's a ton of research to do that. So I hired a science consultant. And then I also found a number of people who were willing to, subject matter experts who were just willing to participate and help me. So I had, I had literal rocket scientists for my science consultant. And then I had a couple of astronauts who were willing to read along and help me with things. So when I got, when I would be writing, I would hit a thing that was a really specific, crunchy detail in a scene, but also a kind of a grace note, right? It's not something that's driving the plot, but it's letting you know that my character is competent. It's setting the stage. It's that kind of thing. And so I would play what I call astronaut Mad Libs. So I would write it, and it would be something like, as she jobbed the job, or jargon, the captain said, as he jargoned the jargon. And then I would send it over to the astronauts, and I would say, could you just fill in the blanks? Could you just play Mad Libs? So technically, parts of these books are written by astronauts.
I was thinking as I was reading it that it's a lot scarier and harder work, actually, to write an alternate history, especially that recent an alternate history, than it writing a far future Handwavian sort of science, because there are so many opportunities for you to mess up something that people actually know you've messed up.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. There are a couple of times where I am tempted to just like throw some random acronyms on the page. and I'm like, no, just keep going. That's a thing. But what I run into with my own brain is that I know how many people learn their science from fiction. And if I have the opportunity to put the right science down on the page, then I will. And most of the time, the constraints of getting the science right cause me to have a better story. If I can't get the science right, then I go vague or don't build a plot point around it, which is why with, as I mentioned before, the asteroid, I know that a water strike, and particularly a shallow water strike, can cause the runaway greenhouse effect, but it was not important to the book to have the size of the asteroid be defined. It's not a plot point.
We knew what it did. That's all that
matters. That's right. Really. So again, it's what she interacts with. So I did just enough. I hand waved the math. Let me rephrase that. The math. There's a point where she's trying to figure out how big it is. She's trying to figure out how big it is, and she's. So what she does is she needs to figure out what it would take to heat up the Chesapeake Bay to the point that it got heated up. So I have them do the math for that, for heating up the Chesapeake Bay. And I had Stephen Grenade, my science consultant, I'm like, I found this formula for figuring out what it would take to heat something up, a body of water like this, but I don't do this math. Please help me. And he did that and walked me through the steps that he had to go through to do the math. And then I took that and used sections of it as my character was kind of working through the problem. So I would have them hum a little bit and just talk out loud. So you just get these pieces of the equation.
Yeah,
which,
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So it really makes it look like I know what I'm doing.
It's all an illusion.
I basically am treating math like a magic system. I establish that my character can do magic using numbers. And then later when I say things like, Elma did the equations, you believe that she can do those equations.
Without having to specify what those equations were.
That's correct, because I was just like, oh, this is...
So
this is a lot.
What did your actual writing process look like? I noticed you say in your bio that you have a lot of manual typewriters. Do you write on a manual typewriter, or is that just something you like to collect?
We like to collect them. I will sometimes do short fiction on manual typewriters, but we just collect them. I predominantly write on my computer, either in Scrivener, or these days my favorite thing is For the Words, the number what? Four. thewords.com, which is a role-playing game that in which the metric for defeating monsters and going on quests is the number of words you write and the time in which you write them.
Oh.
It's really good.
I should check that out for sure.
It's embarrassingly effective. I will write to earn a pair of wings with a dedication that I will not write for a paycheck. So... It's embarrassing how well it works, but it does. So
that might be something I could use to motivate me, I admit.
There are quests. You have an avatar. There are little tiny pets that you can get. Yeah, it's really good.
Hmm. Do you work mostly then in a home office, or do you like to go out to other places, get away from the house, or what's your
All of the above. Since so much of my writing was done, early writing was done in transit, I'm very comfortable writing in kind of wherever I am. Sometimes I will go to a coffee shop because I just need to get out of the house because I've been there for so long. Sometimes I write at home in a chair. Sometimes I write at a desk. I'm staying with friends right now, and I've been writing. They have a solarium, so I've been sitting out there on a couch, and their cat comes and sits with me. So it varies. The only things that are really super consistent are that if there is a conversation, a single conversation near me in which I can distinguish dialogue, I have difficulty concentrating, and I can't write to music with lyrics. Or actually, not just lyrics. I cannot write with the human voice. So even if it's in another language, there's a part of my brain that's trying to figure out what they're saying.
That's interesting because I'm exactly the same way. In a coffee shop, I can write if it's white noise, but otherwise I have to put on headphones if somebody starts talking close enough to me to follow their conversation.
Yeah.
And I can't listen to lyrics either. I listen to classical or instrumental jazz, and it's just background noise. It's just to block out the other noise.
Yeah. The thing that I figured out, so I just finished writing Relentless Moon, which is book 3 in the Lady Astronaut series. Or universe. And while I was in the process of writing it, I had a flight in which I saw Captain Marvel, and the soundtrack for that is so good and empowering and completely stuck in my head, but it's full of all of these lyrics. So I assembled a Spotify list, which are instrumental versions. It's an instrumental Captain Marvel playlist. And it's great. And I am now like, this is because it's all this really driving music. I'm like, this is something that I will consider for future projects as well.
Something I didn't ask you, but this is a good place to ask you because we're getting to the point now. You've got a manuscript. What mm-hmm. do you do with it next in the revision process? Do you have beta read? Well, you talked about some of the people who read it along the way, like astronauts and so forth.
Yes.
But do you have more traditional beta readers? And when you were starting out, were there writing groups and support groups like that that helped you along the way?
Yeah, I started with a writing group very, very early. We recently moved to Nashville, and I don't have one in Nashville, and I miss having a writing group. But what I do with my beta readers is this is very much influenced by the fact that I come from theater, in that I perform better for an audience. So the only times I have gotten the stereotypical writer anxiety was the one novel where I decided not to use beta readers and to like write the thing and then start showing it to people. And I got, like, I don't know, 10 chapters in and was having this is a terrible book and reactions. And the thing that I do is I'll write in, you know, as I said, Scrivener, and then I use Google Drive, Google Docs, and I'll upload a chapter, and I have a list of beta readers who will read it. And I ask them to tell me just 4 basic things. Awesome, so I don't accidentally fix things. When they get bored, when their attention flags, when they're confused, and when they don't believe things. Then I also tell them, like, stream of consciousness thoughts are great, and I enjoy those, but not to give me any kind of line notes at all, because all I'm interested in is whether or not the scene plays. So I think of it as inviting someone to a rehearsal. It's like, it's not even to a dress rehearsal stage, maybe. But I've just, you know, it's like, I've got the show up on its feet. I want to see if this plays. And then I'll adjust, based on what they're confused about. And that helps me kind of, so I'm kind of doing a rolling revision as I go. I stay 2 chapters ahead of them. So, like, if I post chapter 1, that means I have finished writing chapter 3. Then when I finish, and I should say that I usually talk through the outline with someone, like my writer's group or with my agent or editor. So I'm pretty structurally solid by the time I start actually writing. And then this kind of rolling revision process means that I wind up with a fairly clean draft. There's usually things where I'll have a retcon. And I just tell the readers, if I have a major retcon that I need to go back and do, I'll just tell them, like, you know, in a previous scene, the evacuation is going to take place between, but using a rappelling line instead of the inflatable slide. And then I just keep writing as if I've already made that change.
Then when you have got that final draft, do you do another revision just on your own? And what do you look for in that pass?
I look for the same things that I ask my readers to look for. So a lot of times, I think a thing that writers will forget is that they have been thoroughly trained as readers for their entire life, and that we can still have an emotional response to something even if we know exactly what's going to happen. Like, there's a piece of media that you've seen that you love, that you've, you know, you can probably recite lines from and you've seen multiple times. You know, it's Princess Bride. Anybody got a peanut? So the fact that you know where something is going doesn't stop you from having these emotional responses and this cathartic satisfaction. So with my fiction, if I am not having reader responses, like if I find myself getting bored with something, it's probably boring. It probably means that it's not going to stand up to a reread. And, you know, as a writer, if people want to reread my stuff, that's real good. So I try to do a read through in which I am thinking about my own emotional responses to things. Usually when I finish it, like, there's some big picture stuff that I know I need to do, and so I'll do that. But then, like, when I have something that's pretty clean, I'll do a reread and look for the problems, look for the things where I get a little bored, you know, like, oh, look, you just started skimming there. Maybe you should do something with that. The number of times that I'm reading something that I've written, I'm like, what does that even mean? So I'll fix everything that I can identify. And these days, unless I have done a really major structural change, after that, I will send it off to my agent or editor. Before I was agented and and had, you know, books that were for sale, or books that had been sold, I would run it through a different set of beta readers, and see how it played for them, to see whether or not I had accidentally introduced a problem. If I've done a really big structural change, I will often run it through through beta readers before turning it in, through another set of beta readers, but not always. It depends.
And what does your agent and or editor, what sorts of things do they most often flag for you to take another look at, if anything?
It depends on the book. A lot of times it's a pacing issue. Sometimes they'll flag that there's a character opportunity that I missed. Motivation is not clear. And those are the things where it's most likely to have been in my head and to not hit the page. So it's usually something to do with the characters, either the main character or secondary character's internal life. And those are usually pretty easy adjustments to make. But that's for me, the things that I'm usually getting flagged with. Sometimes it's something else that's more fundamentally, you know, a large change. But since I have them involved from the outline phase, it's usually pretty sound by the time I get in there.
Have you had the same editor for multiple books, or have you worked with different editors?
So the first, until Relentless Moon, it has all been Liz Gorinsky for the novels. And now Relentless Moon is Beth Meacham. I'm still with Tor, but Liz left and now has her own company, Erewhon, and is doing quite well. But it was an interesting process switching editors. I've been edited, of course, by a lot of different short fiction writers, but figuring out what the rhythms were and our communication style and things like that, it's an interesting shift. And they flag different things. Each good. But it's an interesting change.
My main publisher is Daw. I'm on my 10th novel with them, and of course that's Sheila Gilbert. So I'm very, very familiar with Sheila's style of editing. Whenever I work with anybody else, it's like, well that's different.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
As it is kind of it's not exactly a marriage, but it's some sort of long-term relationship anyway.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's in a lot of ways you're business partners because you're building a product together, and it sounds really crass, but it is a thing that is happening. Or, you know, theater, you're putting on a show together.
Now, you are, and I would suspect, pleased with the response that the book has gotten.
Yeah, no, that's been very nice. I mean, I'll tell you that, like, the awards are, it's been amazing. And I'm like the whole, hitting all three, was staggering, I would say. But the thing that has been really, it's a tricky thing to talk about, because it was an unexpected thing, that the discussions of anxiety and mental illness in the book, there are a lot of people for whom that hits very hard, and that deal with anxiety and feel like they have never seen themselves on the page before. And so the emails, the fan mail that I get with these books is of a different sort than I've gotten with the other things I've written. And it is really humbling. Like, I am, again, you know, again, it's a theater thing. It's a fiction thing too, but there's a thing that I create, and then there's the thing that the audience sees. Hmm. And a puppet, you know, a puppet is an inanimate object, right? my job is to pick it up and move it. But the thing we say in puppet theater is that the difference between playing with dolls and putting on a puppet show is the audience. Because the audience has to invest part of their belief in the character in order for it to come alive. It doesn't matter how skilled I am at manipulating it. If there's not someone there to watch it and invest part of themselves, it's still just a figure. And so the puppet exists in this liminal space between the performer and the audience. And I feel like books are very much the same way. Like, I wrote a book that satisfied me and that I'm intended to have an emotional impact on my readers. But I did not set out to write a book that was going to speak directly to people with anxiety. Like, that was, the goal was to tell a story about getting to the moon. That was the goal. And I wrote a character that I loved and that I connected with, but this thing that has happened that exists in this liminal space between my book and the reader is something that the reader is responsible for. Like, each reader who picks it up is bringing part of themselves to it. And so it's this humbling thing where I am involved in this act of discovery for these readers. And what I'm doing is that I've given them a tool, but the discovery is generated by them.
Yeah, I often like to say that writing is, we think of it as a solo thing that we do on our own, but it is in fact a completely collaborative art form, because
yes,
it does not exist until it exists in the head of somebody who reads it. And every reader is going to craft really a different story out of the story that you created. It's actually a different story for every individual that reads it in some way or other. So
yeah, I mean, certainly I also get the people who have clearly never realized that there are people in their lives who have anxiety. They're like, why is Elma so whiny? She can fly a plane, but she can't talk in front of a group of people. I don't believe that. I'm like, oh yeah, yeah. No, anyone who has anxiety, they're the best people to have with you in a crisis, because they're like, what, stress hormones? That's Tuesday.
And I would think that you've had some good response. I haven't. Okay. I mentioned to you before we started the show that my wife is an engineer, mm-hmm. and has long been involved in the efforts to get more women involved in engineering. And there's an effort in Canada right now called a 30 by 30, which is to try to increase the percentage of women in the profession to 30% by 2030.
Oh, nice.
And her mother was a doctor who graduated from medical school in 1947. When there were not a lot of other women in her class with her.
No.
At the University of Toronto. So I would think that there would be a segment of the population who that part really speaks to as well.
Yeah, yeah, that's really true. A lot of people in STEM, women in particular, contact me to tell me that it's like, oh yeah, my story was Elma's. But what's horrifying it's really easy to read the book and go, but that was the 1950s. And the number of women who have had that experience in the 21st century of being the only woman in their math class. The fact that there's a campaign to get 30% women, it's like, that's still not, that's still not a lot.
And it's, I will say, I think at the University of Toronto, where my daughter, she's not in engineering, but she just started this year. And I was there for their, when the engineers were having their big thing that they do the first day. There are all these people in yellow shirts and hard hats running around. And I was watching them go by, and it looked pretty much 50-50. And I think they're pretty darn close at the University of Toronto in the engineering program right now. So
I'm going to challenge you on that when you say that it looks 50-50 to find out. Because there is a thing that happens, and this is like well documented, that when there are 30% women in a room or on a bookshelf, that it is perceived as being predominantly women, even though it's not.
Well, in this case, I asked my wife, and she believes that it is close.
Okay.
Closer than 30%, in the high 40s, maybe. So, you know, pretty close.
Okay.
But I confess, I haven't looked it up myself, but I think the University of Toronto, at least, is certainly working hard.
Good.
To make it happen. So I also wanted to talk before I get to my big philosophical questions here, we're just about out of time, but I want to get those in. But I did just want to ask you about the audiobook narration. That's another form of a theater. And yes. I do some of that myself. I'm currently narrating my own books, but I've done a couple of other people's too. How did that come about?
I like to say it's like puppetry, but without the pain. you know, I have this long career doing character voices and talking to myself, because usually there's two performers and you have to do the entire cast. So often you are in dialogue with yourself. So I had that skill set, and my minor in college was theater and speech, specifically doing radio performance. So honestly, I auditioned, and audiobooks are just like trying to do any other form of, you know, any form of writing where there are submission guidelines, and you go and you read the submission guidelines, and then you follow those instructions and you turn in a tape. And then sometimes they'll have you do what is essentially a callback, where they'll say, "Oh, we're thinking about you for this audiobook. Here's a page. Please read that page to us." And then you see what happens. I got lucky. I did a couple of different things, but then started doing the Sean and McGuire series. I was just in the booth this morning to record the fixes on book 13 in the series. So it's nice to have a little bit of job security there. She keeps writing these.
But I have to ask, because having done it, it's an enormously time-consuming thing, recording books. Mm-hmm. Does that... How do you balance that, writing your own stuff and recording the other stuff? You just have time for it? Because I find it's a huge, you know, it just takes so much time.
Well, I don't do self-producing, so I have an engineer, which means that I only have to do the recording part. And
true, which, I do my own engineering, so
yeah, and that's the part that I'm just like, no. If I had to do that, yeah, that the balancing of those two things would be, I think, well nigh into impossible. But balancing just narrating and writing is not bad. I usually, it's, you know, 6 to 8 hours a day of the narration, depending on the book and who I'm recording for. And then I'll get in, you know, an hour or so of writing before or after, depending, again, on the book and where I am. Sometimes I'm doing, like, editing and narration. I will often, you know, do my edits on my lunch break or something. So I don't find it any different than balancing writing with any other day job. And I don't do it often. And like, I mean, I've done 70 some books, but I'm not recording every day. I could be if I were willing to do home records or self records, but I most of my career has been trying to turn down the gigs I don't want to do, and it's not something I'm interested in doing. So I don't, even though that means I have less audiobook work. And then there's also books that I don't want to record. There was a series that I was recording for a company, and the books were very rapey. And I recorded the second one and said, I can't record these. I'm so sorry. I know that you don't want to change narrators mid-series, but I don't want to be involved with these books. I was already using a pseudonym for them, and which, like, I don't do a lot. But I'm like, I don't need to do these books, and I don't want to, so I don't. Which makes it significantly easier to balance.
Yeah, well, it's, when you're reading something out loud, it's, Yeah, if you're not comfortable with the narrative, it would be very difficult, I would think, to...
I mean, I can do it. Like, I can turn in a good performance. It's compelling and all of that. But I'm just like, but I don't want to participate in that.
I'm just going to back up for a minute. I was listening, but I was also checking the enrollment at the University of Toronto. And they're at, I did overestimate. They are apparently at about 35% women at this point.
Yep.
So
thank you for checking. And that was what I, sorry, that was what I guessed.
I had heard a higher number than that, but clearly I had, that was incorrect. So just to finish up here at the sort of the big philosophical question, so, mm-hmm. and you sort of touched on this already with the sort of reaction and, you know, talking about the collaboration with readers. But the first question is, why do you do this? Why do you tell stories? And then the second question is, and what do you hope to accomplish by telling stories? So why do you write, and specifically, why do you write science fiction? Why do you write this crazy stuff?
So I write, and I write, I guess, science fiction because for the same reasons that I do puppetry, it is the theater of the possible. It allows me to take the natural world, tip it on its side, and look at the interconnective tissue, which helps me understand the real world more. The reason I write instead of just doing daydreams is so that I can share those things with other people. It's also, I think, I am a storyteller, and it's something that gives me satisfaction. I like the give and take. I like that conversation with the reader. So I write because it's fun. I enjoy it. As I said, I'm working to turn down gigs I don't want to do. So, you know, ultimately and selfishly, I write because I enjoy it. But the goal with each book is to provoke an emotional response in the reader, and usually to have them share the same emotional journey that I have had when I've been thinking about a character. But each book is different. Each short story is different. Like the specifics of what that emotional response is vary. With the Lady Astronaut books, a lot of what I am thinking about kind of consciously are ways in which to demonstrate a different path, because we do learn so much from fiction. We use it as a means of cathartic experimentation, trying on different selves, and as a reader, I mean, not as a writer. We do that as writers too, but as readers, that's, you know, we're trying on these different lives and these thought experiments. And sometimes it's the thing we want to try on is just escaping the stuff that's going on around us. Sometimes it is purely just for fun, which I think is also a valuable and important thing. But it is, each book we pick up for a reason, to have this journey of some sort. And so I am, as a writer, wanting to create the experience that I have as a reader.
Something that I always say that the reason I write is because I want to give to other people the experience I had as a reader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and create something that people will enjoy as much as I've enjoyed the stuff that I've read. And I think that's a common thread. And what are you working on now?
I am doing the final edits for Relentless Moon. I was actually due day before yesterday, but one of my astronauts got back to me with notes at 10:30 the night before it was due, fortunately, my editor is like, "Wait, you got astronaut notes? Okay, you get some extra days." So I am actually rewriting a scene based on those notes right now. That is literally what I'm doing right before this interview, and what I'm going to do immediately when we're done. And then once I turn that in, I get to start working on a book that is not in the Lady Astronaut universe that I'm very excited about. It's the next book that's going to come out from Tor. So Relentless Moon comes out in 2020. And the book after that is called The Spare Man. And it is a locked room murder mystery on an interplanetary cruise ship.
Ooh.
And it's basically The Thin Man in space. It's, you know, retired detective and a socialite and sparkling witty banter. But on a cruise ship going from the moon to Mars.
That sounds like fun.
I have written the first three chapters of it and the outline. I'm so excited to be writing this book. I cannot tell you. It is frolicking.
And where can people find you online?
The easiest way is to go to my website, maryrobinettekowal.com, my entire long name. And you can check out the website, but actually signing up for my newsletter is probably the best thing, because I'll tell you when I'm teaching classes, when I'm going to be traveling, and I will sometimes put out calls for beta readers and invite people to read my stuff while I'm working on it.
And are you active on Twitter?
Yes, at Mary Robinette, and on Instagram, at Mary Robinette Kowal. Generally speaking, if you type in my name, Mary Robinette, I will pop up. There's.
Yes, I believe you're the only one I've ever heard of. So.
Well, so funny thing, I actually met another Mary Robinette, but it was her last name. and that was very funny. But it's, and Joe Biden's middle name is also Robinette, but there's not a lot of us.
I did not know that about Joe Biden. So that's just, you learn something new every day.
Yeah, you should have seen my double take.
I knew
take
it was Joe R. Biden, but I didn't know that was his middle name.
Yeah, my double take on Inauguration Day was pretty epic.
Well, thanks so much for being on The World Shapers.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. Hope you did too.
I did.
And once again, thanks to Mary Robinette Kowal for being my guest on this episode of The World Shapers. That was a great conversation. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope that you will come back for all of the many conversations that will be happening in the future with people like, Matthew Hughes, Jeffrey A. Carver, Ira Naaman, S.M. Sterling, and Tim Powers has confirmed that he'll be on the show. So that's just a few of the ones that I know for sure, and there are others in the works. Come back often. And if you have missed any episodes, and you may very well have, because I believe this is episode 41, you can find them all on the World Shapers website, which is theworldshapers.com. You can also find the World Shapers on Twitter at theworldshapers. And on Facebook at the World Shapers Podcast. You can find the new Facebook discussion group on there as well, the World Shapers Podcast group. You can find me online, as I said off the top, at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett, and you can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. I should also reiterate that this podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. And as part of that network, I have an advertisement to read from Kinexis Credit Union. And this one is particularly appropriate because Marie Kondo got mentioned in this week's episode of the podcast. And, listen to this ad. Wish you could have Marie Kondo come clean up your finances. If only you could apply the Kondo method to your bills and accounts. At Kinexis, their financial advisors will work with you to streamline and organize your money, creating your own method for cleaning up your finances. Let banking spark joy. Contact a Kinexis financial advisor today by calling 1-800-667-7477. So once again, that's the Kinexis Credit Union, who supports the Saskatchewan Podcast Network, of which this podcast is a member. I think that covers all of the housekeeping details and all of the goodbye stuff, so once again, thank you for listening to the World Shapers podcast, and please do come back over and over in the future to hear more fabulous science fiction and fantasy authors talk about their process of creating the worlds and characters that we have so much enjoyed reading about over the years. That's it for this episode. Bye for now.